Screen Time with John Farty.
Brought to you by Stella Cinemas. Spoil yourself in a truly unique cinematic experience.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Farty. This is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, legendary screenwriter Ed Solomon on writing Bill and Ted, Charlie's Angels and Men in Black. Mark Ryle is here with all the week's new releases, including Enola Holmes, all about Sherlock Holmes' younger sister. Irish actress Lauren Coe on a role in Nocturnal opposite Cosmo Jarvis. Plus, TV presenter Maya Dunphy on her favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Farty. Or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing all right. The whole business of Bond is getting trickier and trickier. They suspended betting earlier in the week on Tom Hardy getting it. Now, at the time of talking to you, there's rumours that that may not be true. So I don't know who Bond is going to be any more than anyone else does at this stage. Tom Hardy, brilliant actor. I just think he's too intense to be Bond. You know, I was saying to someone during the week, instead of drinking a martini, shaking a not stirred, he'd be having a pint of cider or a, you know, a blue wicket, or he just seems like a too much of a tough guy for Bond. But he's a great actor, so and I don't think anyone ever thinks a Bond when they're announced will be that good until you actually see them. So look, hats off to him if he gets it. I'd still like it to be Idris Elba because I think he's the living embodiment of Bond. Anyway, no success for the Irish at the Emmys this week. I have to say, I called it right. Mark Ruffalo won for I Know This Much Is True. I knew that was going to happen. You should watch that show just for his performance, if nothing else. He was incredible in it. But a disappointment for Paul Mescal. But I'm sure he'll be fine. Now, in TV, I was watching this.
Douglas, I've been thinking about leaving. I think our marriage might be over.
So trial separation?
Except not a trial.
What can I change about myself?
We should still go on holiday. We'll have this last summer together.
3 weeks, 6 countries, 12 cities. We're like, I don't know, you too.
That's a clip from Us on BBC on Sunday nights on BBC One. I was really keen to see this. This is based on the book by David Nicholls. Now, David Nicholls wrote that wonderful novel One Day, which they turned into a slightly less wonderful movie, but not a bad movie. And he's a great, great storyteller. Us, as you got a sense from the clip there, and they're being quite faithful to the novel, is, and I've read the book, how very literate of me, but it's a great book. And as you heard there, it's about a man and a woman who are going to go on this big European trip with their one son, but then she decides she wants to leave him. She's come to this conclusion, Connie and Douglas, but they decide to go on the trip anyway. And you also see flashbacks of their younger self. I love the book, and the TV show seems very faithful to it, and it's very well played. Tom Hollander plays Douglas. Saskia Reeves plays Connie and the young son is Tom Taylor. It's really good. There's something about watching BBC on a Sunday night. It's just a warm kind of feeling, you know. Or even watching English TV. Maybe it comes back to our childhood or something. We're all in love with nostalgia at the moment. But Us on BBC. Now, it's on the player, but we don't have that. I think you could follow it from this Sunday night. What happens in the first episode is that they start their tour of Europe. That's all you need to know. You'll be fine. Catch up with it. Start watching it this Sunday. Us. It's very good. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to new release time. This week we're looking at Enola Holmes, a new look at Sherlock Holmes with his sister, and also a new movie called Miss Juneteenth, which is on video on demand and on limited release this week. And of course, to review them, I'm joined by, I suppose you could say, he's the Watson to my Sherlock Holmes. Mark Ryle, how are you?
I'm the Moriarty, I think.
Very good. If only I had more time to think, I would have come up with that. But anyway, Enola Holmes lands on Netflix. Well, it landed on Netflix on Wednesday of this week. I've seen it. But over to you. What's going on here?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say about Enola Holmes is that it's a kid's movie, but it's a really, really
young adult, I believe, is the correct term.
Yeah, it is. Obviously, Enola Holmes is not part of the Arthur Conan Doyle mythology. She was created in a series of young adult novels by Nancy Springer. So that's the kind of the mood of the film is in the young adult genre. But it's a really, really good kids movie. The story is that Millie Bobby Brown, she plays Enola. She's the 16th. She's the 16-year-old younger sister of the absent Sherlock and Mycroft Holmes. She's grown up in blissful isolation with her mother, Helena Bonham Carter, homeschooling her in the arts of code breaking and martial arts. And then her mother mysteriously goes missing, so Enola sends for her brother's help. But rather than investigating her mother's whereabouts, Mycroft just wants to send her off to finishing school. And then Sherlock seems to be preoccupied with other matters entirely. So before you can say the game is afoot, Enola takes matters into her own hands and heads off to London to search for her mother.
And then, of course, into the mix comes Lord, what was his name? Twixbury, played by Louis Partridge as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I thought you were going to talk about Henry Cavill. Yeah, no. It was a Marquess of Tewkesbury.
Marquess of Tewkesbury, that's it, yes.
A very, very long title, which I cannot remember.
Yes, and he kind of enters the thick of it. So I would say, no, the reason why I was saying it was young adult was because I would see it more as, well, kids' movies, one way to describe it, but I would say as a family movie. What did you think of it?
I thought it was fantastic. It's directed by Fleabag's Harry Bradbeer.
And if I can interrupt for 1 second to say he'll be a guest on this show next week.
Well, I was going to mention that as well. But yeah, he directs it with vim and vigor. And he doesn't bring the same kind of adult tone as Fleabag. But what he does bring is that constant breaking of the fourth wall. And it has a really, really hyper energetic style. But Bradbeer, he knows when enough is enough and when to dial it back. So for me, this works much better than Shane Ritchie's two adaptations did, which really did become insufferable at a certain point. And I think at its heart, it has a kind of a weird third act, and there's a couple of false stops at the climax. But I think even when the plot gets a little muddled and aimless, Millie Bobby Brown really carries the whole thing through with enthusiasm and a lot of charm. She's got this boundless energy and enthusiasm for the role. And that energy and enthusiasm could quite easily flip to being flat out annoying, but it never does. And I think that's down to her. She's got an easygoing confidence. And it's incredible to think that she's still really only at the beginning of her career.
And people know her, of course, from Stranger Things.
Yeah.
She's great in this. Like, I really liked it. You and I have bemoaned Netflix movies, you more than me, you know, over the past year, that sometimes it just really feels like they're not making movies in the way we understand them. They're just, you know, I don't know, attempting to tell a story badly at times. Some of their movies.
More often than not, I think they are quite poor. And yeah, they're buying movies rather than making them, but it's the movies that they're buying all seem to be of a similar standard, which is bubbling under mediocre.
Whereas this really wasn't. This had its own sense of pace and style. There was a touch of Downton Abbey about it that I really liked. Like, it was a bona fide movie from beginning, middle and end. And what I also liked about it was, you know, and I said this earlier in the week, my 8-year-old watched it with me, and he's Avengers and Star Wars mad, and he loved it. And that's why it's a real family movie, because we both loved it, you know. Oddly enough, the only bit that I was left cold with was Cavill. I just thought he was a bit too, his Sherlock, who's only kind of a minor character in it, but he was just a bit, I don't know, smarmy and
I think he's
a bit obvious or something.
I think his character really takes a back seat, but that's fine because he's an incidental character and it's not his story. I think Sam Claflin gets a meatier part, and he could, like, I'd say he's a cad and a rotter. You might even describe him as a bounder. But
indeed, you might.
Yeah. I think at its heart, though, Enola Holmes, it carries a very, very positive and progressive message. And although that message might be occasionally delivered in a heavy-handed manner, that's fine because, like you said, you watched it with your kid and he really enjoyed it and got it. And I think it's a movie for 12-year-olds with mushy, pliable minds that are open and ready for that positive message, you know. And in wrapping up, I will say that Lawrence Fox is going to hate it, which is great.
My boy's 8, by the way, so he's ahead of the curve in that way, you know, so I appreciate that. Well, that's Enola Holmes. What are you going to say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it 3.5. I think it's a really good movie, and it was far better than I was expecting, you know.
Okay. I'm going to give it 4 because I found it a ripping yarn.
And, if I was 12, I would give it 4.
Yeah. Or if you were 8 even, you know.
Okay.
Let's take a quick clip of Enola Holmes.
A week ago, I awoke.
Mother?
To find that my mother was missing, and she did not return.
I'm presently on the way to collect my brothers, Mycroft and Sherlock.
Yes, Sherlock Holmes, the famous detective, my genius brother. He will have all the answers.
Enola.
Where's your hat and your gloves?
Well, I have a hat. Just makes my head itch. And I have no gloves.
My God.
A wild woman brought up a wild child. Will make her acceptable for society. She seems intelligent.
That was a clip of Enola Holmes. I gave it 4 stars. Mark gave it 3.5. So we're kind of on the same page with that one. And it's currently streaming on Netflix. Now, Mark, another movie that's available on limited release, but on all video on demand platforms, is Miss Juneteenth, which I haven't seen. Mark, what's going on with Miss Juneteenth?
I should probably begin by explaining what Juneteenth is. Juneteenth is an American holiday that's that celebrates the abolition of slavery in Texas in 1865. And Miss Juneteenth is a long-running beauty pageant, which is similar to the Rosa Tralee, except the contestants don't have to butter up Dahi O'Shea. And the winner gets a college scholarship instead of a new car and a holiday in Kerry. And following, after last week we were talking about Natalie Bianchieri's Nocturnal, this is another impressive debut feature. The writer-director, Shannon Godfrey-Peoples, she brings her own personal experience to bear on, I suppose you could say it's a microcosm of the wider Black experience and the lack of opportunities that are available in a system that's kind of designed to alienate. And the small microcosm here is the story of a mother's bond with her child. And the lead is a phenomenal Nicole Beharie, and she plays Turquoise, who's a former Miss Juneteenth winner. Turquoise, or Turk, won the pageant 15 years ago and then lost her college scholarship when she fell pregnant. And she is now a single mother working more than one job, making sacrifice after sacrifice to make sure that her daughter doesn't want for anything and stays on the straight and narrow. And she's got this unwavering conviction that her daughter's future depends on her winning this year's Miss Juneteenth, which is a conviction that her daughter does not share.
Okay, that's an interesting concept for a movie. And we talked about messages in Enola Holmes. Are you being hit over the head with kind of social realism or, reflections on the Black experience?
Not a bit, no. As I said, this is a character-driven thing. As I said, Nicole Beharie, she's immense. But what I loved about this movie is that every character is well-drawn and multi-layered. And there's a lived-in authenticity that is uncommon. I thought a lot about Barry Jenkins' Moonlight when I was watching this. Every character is more than one thing. For example, Turk's ex and her daughter Kai's father is still on the scene, but as the saying goes, it's complicated. On the page, he is a bit of a bad boy, and at one stage he needs to be bailed out of prison, but there is more to his character than just that one thing. For starters, he's a good father, and there's never a suggestion otherwise. And then at the other end of the age bracket, you have Turk's mother, who's another multifaceted character. She's a devout churchgoer, but she's also a hopeless alcoholic. And there is this suggestion that Turk's upbringing was dysfunctional, which is something that she does not want to pass on to her own daughter. And then as the daughter, we've got Alexis Chakwesi, who's kind of passively rejecting any expectations her mother or her father or her grandmother have for her. And she's just following her own path by quietly letting things play out, you know.
Okay. I can really hear the Moonlight similarity there. It sounds very similar, but nothing wrong with that. Fantastic film.
Yeah, but the draw here is... I suppose while everyone else in her daughter's life can see it, Turk doesn't realize how misguided she's being by trying to push her daughter down this path. She had to defer all of her hopes and aspirations when she fell pregnant. And now she's vicariously living out these hopes and aspirations through her own daughter. And I suppose the charm of Miss Juneteenth is watching her slowly come around to the realization that although she has the best of intentions, at the same time, she might be wrong.
Right. Okay. That sounds great. I'm going to have to check that out. And as I say, it is available on all video on demand platforms. It is going to be in the Palais in Galway this weekend. I've been told by the people who release it. So if you're in Galway, by all means, check it out because it sounds pretty fantastic. So what would you say stars wise, Mark?
I'm going to give it a 3.5. It's a really impressive piece of work for a first time writer director.
That sounded to me like a 4. You sure you don't want to change your mind?
No.
5 seconds.
No, let's not go mad.
Okay. Yeah, let's not use the one of ourselves.
I have given this some thought.
Yeah. No. I appreciate that. Are you sure I can't tempt you? No. Okay. Fair enough. That's 3.5 from Mark again for Miss Juneteenth. It's not easy to say. It's easy to see though, because as I say, it's on various video on demand platforms. And 4 for me and 3.5 also for Enola Holmes, which is now streaming on Netflix. Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, John.
Now, currently in cinemas is Nocturnal, a small Northern English movie with Cosmo Jarvis, Sadie Frost, and a young Irish actress called Lauren Cole. In the movie, which we gave a good review to on this show last week, Cosmo Jarvis' character plays a kind of school handyman who starts to develop a really strange obsession for a young teenager. I won't say any more than that, apart to say it's well worth a watch. And the woman who plays the young teenager is Irish actress Lauren Cole. And I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Hi, Lauren.
Hello, John. How are you?
Before we came on air, I asked you what age you were, which is a terrible thing for a man to ask a woman, really, generally, or anyone to ask anyone. But you told me you were 27. Mm-hmm. And in this, you play kind of around a 16-year-old. You were so believable as a teenager and all that a teenager cares about at that age. Was it hard to get into, aside from the physical thing, but to get into being a teenager?
Well, I'm pretty used to playing teenagers now at this point. I've got quite a small stature, and I have a very young looking face. So I actually never play women of my age. So I think I'm kind of used to regressing now, actually. which is great, but it can be a bit, to be honest, being a teenager is so traumatizing. Like it's so hard to put yourself back into that mind frame all the time. The anxiety of every single move you make is horrendous. Yeah. When you're that age, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, you are great in it, and Cosmo in as well, and Sadie Frost is in it, of course, but it's you and him a lot. And I'm really keen not to give spoilers because there's clearly a very obvious one in it, which we won't get near of. But I presume you two maybe had to do, because so much of it is you and him and the strange obsession he has with you. I presume you had to spend a lot of time together beforehand. Did you, or like talking about it and how that was going to all pan out on screen?
No, we actually didn't.
Okay then.
Yeah, we spent one day together, I think, before we started shooting, or like an afternoon. We met in a rehearsal room when we both arrived to Hull, which was where the film was shot, and we did some kind of exercises with Natalie, the director, which were sort of, and we improvised the scenes a bit. But before that, we hadn't met each other, and I think that was Natalie's intention as well. I think Natalie's actual original intention was for us to be, I think, quite uncomfortable with each other, actually.
Okay.
That's kind of the way I think she wanted it to work, in that she wanted me to pretend to Cosmo that I was 17 for the duration of the shoot. And she asked me this a couple of days before we started. And I just texted her back and I said, I'm a really bad liar. I'm really sorry. I don't think I could do that. Because I knew there was one car to bring us to set every day. And any question he would ask me, I'd have to come up with on the spot, like, oh, what subjects are you studying for your leave insert? Like, I'd have to lie the whole time. And I'm a shocking actress. I'm a shocking liar for an actress. So I just couldn't keep it up. I think I lapsed within 2 days. And then he figured it out.
Okay. Well, that's interesting how it was made up. Now, your character is Irish-English in that you're moving from Ireland back to England to the town that you grew up in. And, you know, I'm cognizant of the fact that you're an Irish girl or an Irish woman living in London now, pursuing the career in acting. Was there, did that give a certain, you know, reality to it for you?
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think I really thought of it in that way. I think because London is such a different landscape to...
It's not Hull.
Yorkshire. No, it's not Hull. And I think... no dissing Hull at all. But I think Laurie, she spent, you know, the most of her dominant years, I guess, in Dublin. And Dublin's kind of very much, you know, I suppose a cosmopolitan city, I suppose, these days. So I think going back to kind of a small town culturally is a very different atmosphere for her. And yeah. I think struggles to make friends and stuff. Whereas I have loads of friends in London, John, okay?
I'm sure you do. I'm still reeling from the fact that you're 27 because you really look like you're about 18 in this. And you mentioned playing teenagers and stuff like that. You've done lots of TV, Primeval, Camelot, Troy. How have things been for you in the last 5 months? Because London and England has been in as serious a lockdown, if not more, than Ireland has. How have the last 6 months been for you?
Well, luckily for me, I actually spent 4 months of lockdown in Dublin with my parents. So I went back kind of straight away in March when stuff was getting serious. And yeah, like it's been a slow, work-wise, it's been kind of a slow trickle. The industry sort of opening up back again now. But I did, I sent off a fair few audition tapes where my mum and dad were reading opposite me. So that was... interesting. No, they honestly did great, the pair of them, but it's just, you know, it's not what one is used to.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. So what is next for you then?
Who knows, honestly, I don't know yet. It's still a very uncertain landscape, but things are picking up. And actually, to be honest, I feel very lucky to be an actor at the moment, because it's one of the industries that in the long run won't actually be affected too much by the coronavirus. Obviously there has to be precautions and stuff on set, and theatre has taken a massive hit, which is extremely saddening to me because I'm a theatre actor as well, and I really love theatre and miss it. But you know, in terms of TV and film work, there's so much still happening, so I feel really grateful actually to be in the industry that I am in and still be able to work without it being too affected.
Yeah. And of course, you you mentioned theatre. You were in one of the many stage versions of Asking for It.
Yes.
What was that like? That's a terrific piece of work. What was it like to be in that?
Asking for It was a real passion project for me. I was first to play the role of Emma back in when we premiered the play in Cork in 2018, I believe, or 2018, and in the Abbey.
So you were actually the first actress who played the role on a stage.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean it was an incredible experience. The whole cast was a complete delight to work with. They were all such lovely people, and I learned a lot from them. The ensemble was really strong, and then it really kind of as a piece, it was very difficult to work on, because as you can imagine, kind of it unravels a lot of your emotions really, and you're kind of very threadbare there. But it was made all the better by just such a lovely cast. And Louise O'Neill, who wrote the book as well, gave us such amazing support. And still, she's actually still a big support to me in my life now at the moment. And we would message actually quite a lot on Instagram and email and stuff. So yeah, just meeting her and bringing her book to life was a real honor. Yeah.
Yeah, great, great. Well, listen, you said you weren't a good liar, but you play very, I've seen you in very dark parts, and you're a very jolly person, so you must be pretty good at it. Nocturnal is really good. It's not like a lot of stuff out there, so I suggest people go see it in cinemas, because it is on a limited release here. Also available on all the video on demand platforms. And chief among the things to recommend it is actress Lauren Coe. So Lauren, I hope the road continues to rise to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, John. Lovely to speak to you.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Brought to you by Stella Cinemas. Spoil yourself in a truly unique cinematic experience.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Ed Solomon is one of the most successful screenwriters of all time. His work includes franchise success like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and of course, Bill and Ted Face the Music, which landed in cinemas last week. He's also the man who wrote Men in Black, Now You See Me, that franchise, Charlie's Angels. He wrote, although he took his name off the first X-Men movie. This guy has been behind a lot of seriously successful pictures. And I got to have a word with him earlier in the week. And of course, I began by talking to him about the return of Bill and Ted in their third movie, Bill and Ted Face the Music. So, Ed, you've probably been asked this ad nauseum, but I have to. The last one was 1991. The world have been waiting on it for a long time to varying degrees. Why did it take so long?
Face the Music took long to get made for a variety of reasons. The first was we didn't think anybody would want to see a third Bill and Ted movie, and we didn't think any of Keanu's reps would even let him do a third movie, certainly for 10 or 15 years. Then in the mid-2000s, for the first time, when Keanu and Alex were asked, hey, do you think there'll ever be another Bill and Ted movie? And trust me, they were asked a lot. For the first time in around 2004 or 5, I think Keanu said, I don't know, there could be, maybe, or something like that.
Yeah.
And Chris and I were like, wait, is that real? Is that possible? And so that began a discussion in the mid-2000s about would we ever really want to do another movie? And if so, under what circumstances? And in 2008, we had dinner over at Alex Winter's house, me and Chris and Keanu, and threw a few ideas around. And Chris and I had had a couple thoughts about what it might be about if we were to do one. And we settled on this notion that if it never really happened for them, if the destiny they were told they had when they were teenagers never materialized, what would life be like for them? And how do they get rid of that pressure? And what does their life become about if it's not about their music?
Mm.
And that seemed like a great place to start. And so then in 2009, we met at my house and we came up with the basic notion, which is, what if the story is you knew you must have written it because they told you you'd written it in the future, but it hasn't happened yet. So therefore, you haven't written it yet, but you're about to. So what if you go into the future to when you have written it and steal it from yourself? Once we had that notion, we had the spine for what the story would be.
Mm.
And then we thought it's just a matter of writing the script and people will die to get it made. Will be no problem. Well, we wrote it on spec so we could get it right. On spec meaning nobody's paying us. We're just writing it, which is really stupid if you consider the fact that we didn't own the rights to it. We just wrote it on spec with the assumption that MGM, who owned the rights, would be thrilled.
Hmm.
We marched it into them maybe 2010, 2011, and they were like, well, thanks. Well, we kind of already have a Bill and Ted movie we're planning to make with these two YouTube stars where Bill and Ted travel with a cell phone and they're 20 years old. And I was like, oh my God, we all were sort of bummed about it, to be honest. We were all like, you're kidding. Thankfully, that didn't happen. But that was the first reason it took so long to get made. The second reason it took so long to get made was all the numbers that the people who do finances for movies rely on to determine whether a film is, you know, worth making a sequel to, those numbers didn't support it because the movie itself didn't get much of an international release when it first came out, Excellent Adventure.
Mm.
And even in the States, it didn't really do that well. It did well enough to get a sequel, but it really had more of a cult following. It wasn't until decades had passed that somehow the movie had grown. People just had discovered it over 20 years, that all the evidence that there was, you know, an audience for a sequel was anecdotal. It wasn't there was no numbers to back it up. Everywhere I'd go, people would ask about it, but it was very hard to prove to the financiers that that was the case. So MGM, even though they decided not to make the other version of the movie, they did give us permission to go everywhere to try and get it set up. And we went to every studio in Hollywood. We went to every independent financier. We did everything, and we still couldn't get it made. It wasn't until 2016 we got it set up at a place called STX. We did a draft. They put it in turnaround. And then in 2018, Scott Kruf, our producer, brought in this guy, Alex Leibovich, who was another producer. And he said, I am going to bust my ass to get this thing made. And he did raise the money. And we finally, by 2019, were able to go into production. So that's why it took so long.
Wow. It's a very long story to a very short question. But that was a long, long time. And, you know, it's fascinating because now, you know, you read about Bill and Ted. They've become these cultural icons and, you know, they're allayed with all sorts of other people and the catchphrases and all that. And it's funny to look back on it now and hear that it wasn't that big a commercial success. I mean, the movie business, not that you need me to tell you, is a very strange one. I was taken with the kids, the kind of conceit of having these young Bill and Ted, and they're girls now. Was that a, I don't know, were you saying, and there's a nice line, well, I won't give a spoiler, but they pay a very nice tribute to them towards the end. Was that, I don't know, the world at large seeping into your writing brain, just with all that's happened in the world of Hollywood lately in terms of inclusion and gender balance?
Well, was it the world at large? Yes. Was it Hollywood inclusion and gender balance? No, absolutely not. It was more the world at large. Mm-hmm. It was more Chris and I realizing that writing Little Bill and Ted as boys made the movie feel very derivative of the first Bill and Ted. We had seen young Bill and Ted as teenage boys. They were Bill and Ted. And we did try initially. We wrote them as Will and Theo initially. And it was never good, literally, never good. They were either too much like Bill and Ted, or they were like cool guys, which was no good and not funny. And we really struggled. Sometime in the mid-teens, 2015, 2016, we decided to make them girls. That was before the Me Too movement, so to speak.
Sure.
But we decided to make them girls, and the primary reason was creative. The primary reason was it just wasn't working as boys. And once we made them girls, it opened the movie up in a gigantic way. But that is not to say we weren't aware of the fact that Ted was a pretty male-centered movie. Its themes were the themes that would be the themes of movies written by adolescent men, which was what we were when we wrote the movies. And now we're adults and we're older and we've lived life and we have boys and we have girls and we're in the world and we see how the world is changing and we wanted to be more inclusive. Yes.
Yeah.
But it was primarily a creative reason.
Sure. Yeah, no, I get that. I mentioned that it's become this cult classic and it's everywhere. Apparently, and I wasn't aware of this, but I was looking around today, your current president described himself as a very excellent student. And some guy on the internet had traced this back to Bill and Ted. Is that a legacy that you're proud of or disdainful of?
Wait a minute. Is that true?
According to the internet, that's never wrong. No, Trump described himself as a very excellent student. And some guy was saying this, he clearly got this from Bill and Ted. Now, that may be apocryphal, but apparently he did describe himself as a very excellent student.
Well, we all know, in fact, from those who went to college with him and those who have seen his actual grades, that he was quite a bogus student. But I don't know if I would be pleased to have anything of mine trickle through Trump's mouth, to be honest, because then I would immediately have to distrust what it was. I have seen instances where Bill and Ted has creeped into culture in a political way, and sometimes it's really fun. I remember in the Bill Clinton, Al Gore campaign had an official T-shirt that said Bill and Al's Excellent Adventure on the front and George and Dan's Bogus Journey on the back. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
I thought I mean, if Trump ever did quote something directly from Bill and Ted, I think I would pass out, but not in a good way.
Okay. Well, funny you should mention politics. Well, I brought it up, sorry, but this might amuse you, or you might be curious about this. I was in college a long, long time ago, and I remember we had this very fascinating philosophy professor, and he was saying that in the 90s, American culture started looking at aliens because during the Clinton era, they had moved away from the Cold War. So there was this desire to find enemies somewhere else, that the evil empire of Russia was now over. And he cited Men in Black as a classic example of this. And here I am, as fate would have it, talking to the man who wrote Men in Black. And I'm just wondering, is there any, do you put any credence in that, that that was a time in America when there was no one to fight, so people got interested in aliens? Or is that just a philosophy professor saying something that was completely wrong?
Well, it's a great question, except I would disagree with your philosophy professor a little bit, because E.T. was 1983, and that True. Was Reagan, and yeah. that was, you know, very Cold War.
Yeah.
And that was, and then there was Close Encounters before that, and that was probably sometime around the Carter administration.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say his premise was correct specifically about culture at that time. However, I would say it was very clear to me. I knew the metaphor that I was, or is it an analogy? Is it a metaphor? I knew the metaphor that I was working with in the opening scene of the movie, when it was INS agents at the border trying to track down aliens, and the aliens that came in were actually a different kind of alien. I was very aware of that at the time. And I also was very aware of the idea that the common enemy, so to speak, could be the sort of thing that unites myopic, constantly warring humans.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a draft of Men in Black. There was an early draft of Men in Black where that was a bigger theme. So you're 100% correct in terms of pinpointing that in Men in Black, though I believe its cultural roots started a decade and a half or two before that.
Sure. Well, you would know, you wrote the thing, so that just popped into my head. I'm sorry we went down a strange cul-de-sac. Can I ask you one other thing outside of Bill and Ted? You also wrote episodes of It's the Gary Shandling Show, not to be mistaken with the Larry Sanders Show, which came afterwards. And, you know, that was such a...
Yes.
We used to get that over here in Ireland in the early 90s on one of the English channels that was shown to us. And it was kind of a revolutionary show at the time. I don't think it always gets the kudos it deserves. It was, as you know better than anyone, Gary Shandling playing a fictionalized version of himself who's talking to the audience in the sitcom. And he broke this fourth wall all the time, which has become a really popular trope nowadays, it seems. Was that just a gig for you at the time, writing that show? Like, I think you did 8 episodes, or did you have a sense, man, this is something meaty and different we're doing here?
I actually worked on that for 3 seasons as a staff writer, and I think I've been credited with 8 episodes.
Oh, okay.
It was beyond a gig for me.
Right.
It was, Gary was one of the first people who I've ever worked with who believed in me. I met Gary when I was 19 years old, and I was doing stand-up comedy, and I began writing for Gary, writing jokes for Gary. And so when Gary had this TV show, he asked me if I wanted to work on it. They had written pilot already, and I was like, yeah. So I worked on the first 3 seasons of that show, and it was so much fun, partially because none of us knew what we were doing. None of us did. And so we would write these stories that, just through lack of skill, we would write ourselves into such a corner that we would have to either break the fourth wall to get out of it or come up with some conceptual notion, because we'd written our entire budget out by the 3rd scene. So suddenly we had to do the rest of it using, you know, a toy airplane instead of an actual airplane set. So things like that emanated from cluelessness and then became solved by cleverness, I guess.
Yeah.
We got lucky there. But I got to work with some genius comedians and brilliant writers, people who could get to jokes in ways I never could. Al Jean and Mike Reiss, Tom Gamble, and Max Prost, Alan's wife, Elle, Gary Shandling. It goes on and on. And there are so many incredible people I got to work with. That was really fun. And that was just us in our youth playing in an office with nobody paying any attention. So that was a great learning experience for me,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Well, listen, I told the nice people in Warner I wouldn't keep you too long. So thanks very much for talking to me, Ed. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thanks for having me. I apologize if my answers were too long for you.
Not at all. Not at all. Never apologize for that. Thanks.
But anytime.
Ed Solomon there. I really enjoyed talking to him. And he actually told me to call him anytime, which was nice. You know, sometimes those guys are on a, you know, I'm just a name on a list and it's like, who's next? John who? Farty? He wasn't like that. He was a very nice guy. Up next, a very nice lady, Maya Dunphy, on her favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Brought to you by Stella Cinemas. Spoil yourself in a truly unique cinematic experience.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. Maya Dunphy is one of Ireland's best known TV presenters, and she's back on her screens as of last Sunday with What Planet Do You Think You're On?, which I saw really aptly described, I thought, as an eco-friendly version of Iris Phillips' Family, which I like. I'm not sure if she does. But she's here ostensibly to tell us about her favourite movie. Hello, Maya. Thank you for coming into studio.
That's a lovely introduction. Yeah, back in studio. No more Zoom calls over the phone.
Yeah.
Place stinks of antiseptic, but as it should be. As it should be.
That was me.
Well, that's just your aftershave, isn't it?
We'll get to the new show on Sunday nights on RT1 at 6:30.
Yep.
But your favourite movie is a sheer delight. I've been doing this show close on 2 years and we do this every week and no one has chosen it. So tell our listeners what you've opted for.
I have gone for Back to the Future.
Oh.
Obviously the original one. Now, first, I have to say something. I am a cinema fanatic.
Great.
But a cinema fanatic more than a movie fanatic. I love the experience of going to the cinema. I will almost go and see anything. I think it's an amazingly blissful way to spend even an afternoon on your own or a Saturday morning. I love going to the cinema.
So has the last 6 months been tough for you then?
Yeah, it has actually. Yeah. And my son is 5. I've tried to get him into the cinema. And we used to have Cinema Tuesdays when he was in creche. He did a half day on Tuesday. And I went, you know, whatever kids, we saw some doozies. Oh my God, there were some awful ones. The new Addams Family, the cast they had. I could have written a better script on a Monday morning in a bad mood.
Stay in the light. Anyway, stay in the light.
So I started going to the mother and baby screenings when he was born. You can bring your baby in your car seat. And I was getting my popcorn and Diet Coke at 10:30 on a Monday morning in London with the sounds of other babies screaming. I just love the experience of going to the cinema. Yeah.
So you'd watch anything kind of just to be in a cinema?
I remember when I went to the mother and baby screen, the first one they were showing was Kung Fu Panda 3. And I said to the 15-year-old guy at the desk, I said, are they actually kids' films? He goes, no, it's just like whatever you know goes on that morning. And I kind of joked that I haven't seen 1 and 2, but I follow the narrative. And he went, oh, I don't know, actually. But I managed to keep up with Kung Fu Panda 3.
Well done.
But Back to the Future, when I was asked my favourite film.
Back to the Future.
It's probably the first film that had a really big effect on me. It was 1985, so I was 9, going on 10. I went on my own with my friends. It was the first one I remember going to on my own as well. And I was mesmerised by it. Mm. And I think as well, you have to remember the 80s. It was a long time ago. These were times we didn't have access to everything online. We didn't have access to streaming and Netflix and illegal downloads and even YouTubing your favourite star. Or access. Now you've access to Brad Pitt on Instagram. Maybe you don't, but people like that.
Yeah.
You know, but back then, movies were kind of, they really were something that was a different world. And
yeah.
I remember going to see it. And also, then you had to wait maybe a year for the VHS to come out to
That's
see it again.
True. Yeah, and so, there was queues into the cinema.
Yeah.
People forget. I just realised, I think we're exactly the same age then.
Oh, really?
Were you born in 1975?
Yes, I was.
There you go. Anyway, let's get out of that rabbit hole of ageing radio people TV people.
Face the radio.
There was queues.
Me, not you.
There was queues to go into the cinema and stuff, and it was such a delight to actually then finally get in and be sitting there. Kids don't get that nowadays. You roll up to the multiplex and all. Anyway.
And the movie stayed in screens for sometimes months on end because there was nowhere else to see them. It was great.
And it would come out in America 6 months beforehand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you counted the days. And it was the first time I remember, because I'd seen E.T. in the cinema and I had been, I think I was bad damaged for life after that. I don't think, I had never knew such sadness. And I had seen other films, but that was the first film that I felt like I had a crush on the lead actor. I walked out and thought, my life has been changed by that movie.
Michael
really was.
Fox.
Yeah. Oh. And now I was talking to, I did, I don't want to bring this up too much, but Dancing with the Stars a couple of years ago.
And the start Dance of, away, my
At
dear.
The start of that, at the initial interview stage, you're asked for your favourite film, presumably okay. if there's a movie week, and I said Back to the Future. Now, when it came to movie week, they gave Back to the Future to Jay Carter, who was the eventual winner. We were talking about the movies we'd been assigned over breakfast, 7 o'clock one Sunday morning, and Jake said, oh, I've been given Back to the Future. He said, I never saw it. Like, that's a really old film, isn't it? Because he was born in 1999. And... Oh,
good heavens.
I know, so that was...
So you think he won because he used Back to the Future?
No, I don't. I'm just saying that when I bring up these films, when you meet someone who at a time as a peer, because you're yeah. doing something at the same time as them, and suddenly you're catapulted back into, oh my God, I'm a 70s baby and he was born in 1999.
Yeah.
But it was just, it was a mesmerising film. And since then...
Do you still watch it?
Sorry, if it comes on, if I stumble across it at any point... Mm. On any channel, I will stop and watch the rest yeah. of it. You know those sort of films?
Oh, absolutely, I do. And that's one of the key ones. And there was Christopher Lloyd as well as the mad scientist. Like, I loved him in it as well as
yeah.
Michael J. Fox.
And funny enough, people have often said it's his greatest role, and I would kind of, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
And I became obsessed then over the years buying various magazines and collectibles of, you know, trying to find the little kind of hidden secrets in it and Easter eggs, as they were called, and little mistakes and things. But, and of course now, you know, I think it stands up to scrutiny. But of course, you know, you can't apply 2020 morals and to a film made in 1985. Yeah. And there are people who pick holes in it now about what could or couldn't happen. And then do you remember, because the film...
Because time travel is confusing.
It is, it can be. Yeah. It's a little esoteric.
Yeah.
But 1985, they went back to 1955. Yeah. And then at the end of the film, they jumped to 2015, which at the time felt like... I won't even be alive in 2015. And do you remember five years ago, there was a whole thing, thread on Twitter about where are the hoverboards?
Yeah.
We still need roads.
where we're going, we don't need roads. What about the other two, Back to Future 2 and 3? Do they do it for
Do you know
you,
what? I think it's also, it's the age you are. I mean, I've seen so many brilliant films in the last 20 years, but... the age you are when something captures your imagination. Yeah. And to be honest, by the time 2 and 3 came out, I was getting a little bit older. I liked them, but nothing caught my imagination like the first one.
Yeah, you were starting to listen to The Cure or whatever you young
never,
kids were
never
doing
a cure.
At the
oh
time.
God, I'm afraid I was probably a Stock Aitken and Waterman geek.
Well, that is a wonderful choice and wonderfully described, Back to the Future. We haven't even discussed the plot really because everyone knows it. And if you haven't seen it, you should watch it. Now,
did you like 2 and 3?
I love them all. And I remember before the proclivity of streaming and all that, my wife got me the box set of the three of them.
Yeah.
And it came in this special case. And it's one of my most prized possessions. And when we went to move house about 3 years ago, people were saying to me, sure, don't keep your DVDs. And it's like, I can't throw these out, even though I don't need them
That's
anymore. To see them on a shelf, it's just
I did that recently.
You know?
And I have a little storage room in my apartment, cupboard, it's not a room. And I had three shelves of CDs and DVDs. And I went online and I bought one of those huge, big folders you can put 600 things into. But the box sets I kept were Back to the Future, and I have the Godfather trilogy, and because they're in commemorative special keepsake collector's boxes.
You're speaking my language.
I know, so they're
I'm
the only
glad
two
you
that
came
I kept.
In.
Oh, well, so am I.
So, what planet are you on? I said kind of euphemistically, but it was described like that. Ireland's Fittest Family, done through an echo voice. But explain it to people who haven't seen it. Lots of people are watching it, according to the figures. But it is kind of a challenge between four families to see how eco-friendly they can live. Is that correct?
It is. It started last year, and last year it was part of RT's Science Week, so it ran three consecutive nights, and it was very much a science program. Mm-hmm. But it caught people's imagination. It was quite entertaining. The concept is, we challenged, last year it was three, this year four families or households, to lower their carbon footprint over a period of 4 weeks with the help of, we have four experts across four categories, waste, water, diet and energy. And It's not a sanctimonious finger-wagging show.
No.
That's what I like about it.
Yeah.
Because I think these families make the mistakes so we don't have to, or point them out so we don't have to admit to them. So it's everything from leaving taps running and, you know, what I've learned from it is about emissions, you know, emissions from food that I hadn't even thought about. Obviously, like, we waste a lot of water in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's raining all the time, we think that we can.
Yeah.
But this year was interesting because last year, I think like any sort of reality-style show, the first year, people don't know what they get themselves into. But this year, they did. But they are so competitive this year. And the prize fund...
And they can
fund,
win cash.
Yeah. Last year, the prize fund was €2,000. But there was a very kind of warm final where we said, you know, you've all done so well. We've learned so much. Thank you so much. You're all getting €2,000. This year, That's not happening. There's the prize fund has gone up to $5,000. There's only one prize of $5,000. So
for
only
the best family.
Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. Before I let you go, and that's on Sunday nights. Now, finally, then, I just want to ask you about your career. You began life as a TV producer, a behind the scenes person. And now you're very much in front of the camera. Is that because there are so many people who don't make that transition? Was it by accident or was it by you saying, you know what, I've been behind the scenes enough, I really want to do this myself because I think I could do a good job of it? Was that how it happened?
No, there's a bit of a kind of incorrect belief that everybody who works in telly wants to be on camera, which isn't actually true. And I was very happy behind the scenes, and it was a happy accident. I started writing a column for a newspaper, and I'd written an article about, it was Helen Mirren winning the Oscar for The Queen. And at the time, she was already in her early 60s, but every single interviewer asked her if she had regretted not having children, which is such a bizarrely intrusive question to a woman who, at that point in her life, either she didn't want them, but either way, the ship has sailed. So why ask a woman that? And when you wouldn't ask a man who was 62 who just won an Oscar.
Absolutely.
And I wrote an article, you know, a humorous article as well about this in the newspaper. And at the time, RT were doing Reality Bites.
Reality Bites. Oh my goodness,
how can I not remember? So someone said to me, why don't you make a documentary about that? Because I just turned 35 and I was newly married. So that was, you know, 35 is that buzz age that women are told. After that, your fertility drops off a cliff.
Yeah. Geriatric mother is the correct term.
Exactly. That was never used. I had Tom at 39. It was never used for me.
Anyway.
They didn't dare. So yeah, it went
from
there.
They knew better.
Yeah, but that was very much an authored documentary. Yeah. But then sometimes you get offered an opportunity like, what planet are you on? Yeah. It's something that interests me. I wouldn't be a presenter for hire as such, which is lucky because there's not that much work out there.
Yeah.
And I would still lean towards being behind the scenes. And I like being involved in the production side of things and the writing side of things. But it's nice also. I mean, there's no denying when you're front of camera, it opens more doors.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be here otherwise.
Don't say that.
You wouldn't say, here's a randomer who once wrote for Podge and Rudge.
Well, look, it's lovely to have you here in person. Her favourite movie is Back to the Future. Her latest TV show, What Planet Are You On, is on RT1 on Sunday nights at 6:30. Watch it. It's good fun. I watched about 30 minutes of last week in advance of watching this. Sorry it wasn't more time. As I mentioned, I had three kids, but 30 minutes is a lot.
It's no excuse.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
You got to help me. You were the only one who knows how your time machine works.
Invented any time machine.
Okay, all right, I'll prove it to you. Look at my driver's license. It expires 1987. Look at my birthday, for crying out loud. I haven't even been born yet. And look at this picture. It's my brother, my sister, and me. Look at her sweatshirt, Doc. Class of 1984.
Pretty mediocre photographic fakery. They cut off your brother's hair.
I'm telling the truth, Doc. You gotta believe me.
Then tell me, future boy, who's president of the United States in 1985?
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan? The actor? Then who's vice president? Jerry Lewis.
A clip there from the glorious, wonderful Back to the Future. Just a warm hug, that movie, whenever I watch it. I could watch it to the end of my days. I could probably watch it every day if I had to. It would be no hardship on me. That's it for this week. Thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. Next week, I'll be talking to Fiona Shaw, Harry Bradbeer, the director of Fleabag, all about Enola Holmes. Just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app. Feel free to rate it, review it, tell your friends about it. It's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open all week long on Twitter, John_Fardy, or email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Leave you with some music from the movies. The lovely Elbow with the lovely love song, called What Time Do You Call This, from the movie Man Up, contains the line, don't expect constant sex. Sage advice. Have a good week. What time do you call this? What time do you call this? What time do you call this? Raining, bewildered all my
shining out as the crown. Love was just a word that friends didn't mention. Love was just a joke till it battered me senseless. Oh, shrink with me, towel with me, wither with me, flower with me, endlessly follow me. Swallow me, stay at least for now with me, drinking, dancing round with me, tell me when I go too far, stay precisely where you are. Spelling.